Side 8, A Fire Upon the Deep, by Werner Venge. Continuing on page 169. You could think and feel both at the same time. Steele bent down on a lip, trying to stifle his shivering. It was like having sex with a corpse. Finally, Jeffrey stepped back, holding his hand up. He said something very fast, and Omdi said, "Oh, Lord Steele, you're hurt. See the blood." There was red on the human's paw. Steele looked at himself. Sure enough, one rump had taken a nick. He hadn't even felt it in all the excitement. Steele backed away from the Mathis and said to Omdi, "It's nothing. Are you and Jeffrey unhurt?" There was a rattling exchange between the two children, almost unintelligible to Steele. "We're fine. Thank you for protecting us." Fast thinking was something that Flenser had carved into Steele with knives. "Yes, but it never should have happened. The woodcarvers disguised themselves as workers. I think they've been at this for days, waiting for a chance at you. When we guessed the fraud, it was almost too late. You really should have stayed inside when you heard the fighting." Omdi hung his head ashamedly and translated to Jeffrey. "We're sorry. We got excited, and then we thought you might get hurt." Steele made comforting noises. At the same time, two of them looked around at the carnage. Where was the white jackets that had deserted the stairs right at the beginning? That pack would pay. His line of thought crashed to a halt as he noticed Tyrethect. The Flenser fragment was watching from the meeting hall. Now that he thought about it, he'd been watching since right after the battle began. To others, his posture might seem impassive, but Steele could see the grim amusement in the fragment's expression. He nodded briefly at the other, but inside Steele cringed. He had been so close to losing everything, and the Flenser had noticed.
"Well, let's get you two back to Hidden Island," he signaled to the keepers that had come up behind the starship.
"Not yet, Lord Steele," said Omdi. "We just got here. A reply from Ravna should arrive very soon."
Teeth grated, but out of sight of the children.
"Yes, please do stay. But we'll all be more careful now, right?"
"Yes, yes,"
Omdi explained to the human. Steele stood forelegs on shoulders and patted Jeffrey on the head. Steele had Shrek take the children back into the compound. Till they were out of sight, all his members looked on with an expression of pride and affection. Then he turned and walked across the pinkish mud. Where was that stupid white jackets? The meeting hall on Starship Hill was a small temporary thing. It had been good enough to keep the cold out during the winter, but for a conference of more than three people, it was a real madhouse. Steele stomped past the Flenser fragment and collected himself on the loft with the best view of the construction work. After a polite moment, Tyrethect entered and climbed to the facing loft. But all the decorum was an act for the groundlings outside. Now Flenser's soft laughter hissed across the air to him, just loud enough for him to hear.
"Dear Steele, sometimes I wonder if you are truly my student. Or perhaps some changeling inserted after my departure. Are you trying to screw us up?"
Steele glared back. He was sure there was no uneasiness in his posture. All that was held within.
"Accidents happen. The incompetent will be culled."
"Quite so. But that appears to be your response to all problems. If you hadn't been so bent on silencing the digger teams, they might not have rioted, and you would have had one less accident."
"The flaw was in their guessing. Such executions are a necessary part of military construction."
"Oh? You really think I had to kill all those who built the halls under Hidden Island?"
"What? You mean you didn't? How..."
The Flenser fragment smiled the old fanged smile.
"Think on it, Steele. An exercise."
Steele arranged his notes on the desk and pretended to study them. Then all of them looked back at the other pack.
"Tyrethect, I honor you because of the Flenser in you. But remember, you survive on my sufferance.
You are not the Flenser-in-waiting. The news had come late last fall, just before winter closed the last pass over the ice fangs. The packs bearing the rest of the master hadn't made it out of Parliament Bowl. The fullness of Flenser was gone forever.
That had been an indescribable relief to Steele, and for a time afterward the fragment had been quite tractable.
Not one of my lieutenants would blink if I killed all of you, even the Flenser members. And I'll do it if you push me hard enough, I swear I will.
Of course, dear Steele, you command.
For an instant the other's fear showed through.
Remember, Steele thought to himself. Always remember. This is just a fragment of the master. Most of it is a little school teacher, not the great teacher with a knife.
True, its two Flenser members totally dominated the pack. The spirit of the master was right here in this room, but gentled. Tyrethect could be managed, and the power of the master used for Steele's ends.
Good, Steele said smoothly. As long as you understand this, you can be of great use to the movement. In particular, he riffled through the papers, I want to review the visitor situation with you.
I want some advice.
Yes.
We've convinced Ravna that her precious Yefri is in imminent danger. Andi Yefri has told her about all the woodcarver attacks and how we fear an overwhelming assault.
And that may really happen.
Yes. Woodcarver really is planning an attack, and she has her own source of magical help. We have something much better.
He tapped the papers. The advice had been coming down since early winter. He remembered when Omdi Yefri had brought in the first pages, pages of numerical tables, of directions and diagrams, all drawn in neat but childish style. Steele in the fragment had spent days trying to understand. Some of the references were obvious. The visitor's recipes required silver and gold in quantities that would otherwise finance a war. But what was this liquid silver? Tyrethect had recognized it. The master had used such a thing in his labs in the Republic. Eventually, they acquired the amount specified, but many of the ingredients were given only as methods for creating them. Steele remembered the fragment musing over those, scheming against nature as if it were just another foe. The recipes of mystics were full of horn of squid and frozen moonlight. The directions from Ravna were sometimes even stranger. There were directions within directions, long detours spent in testing common materials to decide which really fit the greater plan. Building, testing, building. It was like the master's own method, but without the dead ends. Some of it made sense early on. They would have the explosives and guns that Woodcarver thought were her secret weapons. But so much was still unintelligible, and it never got easier. Steele and the fragment worked through the afternoon planning how to set up the latest tests, deciding where to search for the new ingredients that Ravna demanded. Tyrethect leaned back, hissing a wondering sigh.
Stage built upon stage, and soon we'll have our own radios. Old Woodcarver won't have a chance.
You are right, Steele. With this you can rule the world. Imagine knowing instantly what is happening in the Republic's capital and being able to coordinate armies around that knowledge. The movement will be the mind of God.
That was an old slogan, and now it could be true.
I salute you, Steele. You have a grasp worthy of the movement.
Was there the teacher's contempt in his smile?
Radio and guns can give us the world, but clearly these are crumbs from the visitor's table. When do they arrive?
Between 100 and 120 days from now. Ravna has revised her estimate again. Apparently even the two legs have problems flying between the stars.
So we have that long to enjoy the movement's triumph, and then we are nothing less than savages. It might have been safer to forego the gifts and persuade the visitors that there is nothing here worth rescuing.
Steele looked out through the window slits that cut horizontally between timbers. He could see part of the starship compound and the castle foundations, and beyond that, the islands of the fjord country. He was suddenly more confident, more at peace, than he'd been in a long time. It felt right to reveal his dream.
"You really don't see it, do you, Tyrifect? I wonder if the whole master would understand, or whether I have exceeded him, too. In the beginning, we had no choice. The starship was automatically sending some sort of signal to Ravna. We could have destroyed it. Maybe Ravna would have lost interest. And maybe not. In which case, we would be taken like a fish gilled from a stream. Perhaps I took the greater risk, but if I win, the prize will be far more than you imagine."
The fragment was watching him, heads cocked.
"I've studied these humans, Yefri, and, through my spies, the one down at Woodcarver's. Their race may be older than ours, and the tricks they've learned make them seem all-powerful. But the race is flawed. As singletons, they work with handicaps we can scarcely imagine. If I can use those weaknesses..." "You know the average Tynes cares for its pups. We've manipulated parental sentiments often enough. Imagine how it must be for the humans. To them, a single pup is also an entire child. Think of the leverage that gives us."
"You're seriously betting everything on this? Ravna isn't even Yefri's parent."
Steele made an irritated gesture. "You haven't seen all of Omdi's translations."
Innocent Omdi, the perfect spy.
"But you're right. Saving the one child is not the main reason for this visit. I've tried to find out their real motive. There are 151 children in some kind of deathly stupor, all stacked up in coffins within the ship. The visitors are desperate to save the children, but there's something else they want. They never quite talk about it. I think it's in the machinery of the ship itself."
"For all we know, the children are a brood force, part of an invasion."
That was an old fear, and after watching Omdi Yefri, Steele saw no chance of it. There could be other traps, but... "If the visitors are lying to us, then there is really nothing we can do to win. We will be hunted animals. Maybe generations from now we'll learn their tricks, but it will be the end of us. On the other hand, we have good reason to believe that the two legs are weak, and whatever their goals, they do not involve us directly. You were there the day of the landing, much closer than I. You saw how easy it was to ambush them, even though their ship is impregnable and their single weapon a match for a small army. It is obvious that they do not consider us a threat. No matter how powerful their tools, their real fears are elsewhere. And in that starship, we have something they need. Look at the foundations of our new castle, Tyrithex. I've told Omdi Yefri that it is to protect the starship against Woodcarver. It will do that later in the summer when I shatter Woodcarver upon its ramparts. But see the foundations of the curtain around the starship? By the time our visitors arrive, the ship will be invaulted. I've done some quiet tests on its hull. It can be breached. A few dozen tons of stone falling on it would quite nicely crush it. But Ravna is not to worry. This is all for the protection of her prize. And there will be an open courtyard nearby, surrounded by strangely high walls. I've asked Yefri to get Ravna's help on this. The courtyard will be just large enough to enclose Ravna's ship, protecting it, too. There are many details still to be settled. We must make the tools Ravna describes. We must arrange the demise of Woodcarver well before the visitors arrive. I need your help in all those things, and I expect to receive it. In the end, if the visitors are treacherous, we will make the best stand that can be. And if they are not? Well, I think you'll agree that my reach has at least matched my teacher's. For once, the Flenser fragment had no reply. The ship's control cabin was Yefri and Domdi's favorite place in all of Lord Steele's domain. Being here could still make Yefri very sad, but now the good memories seemed the stronger, and here was the best hope for the future. Omdi was still entranced by the window displays, even if the views were all of wooden walls. By their second visit, they had already come to regard the place as their private kingdom, like Yefri's treehouse back on Straum. And, in fact, the cabin was much too small to hold more than a single pack. Usually a member of their bodyguard would sit just inside the entrance to the main hold, but even that seemed to be uncomfortable duty. This was a place where they were important. For all their rambunctiousness, Omdi and Yefri realized the trust that Lord Steele and Ravna were placing in them. The two kids might race around out of doors, driving their guards to distraction, but the equipment in this command cabin was to be treated as cautiously as when Mom and Dad were here. In some ways, there was not much left in the ship. The data sets were destroyed. Yefri's parents had them outside when Woodcarver attacked. During the winter, Mr. Steele had carried out most of the loose items to study. The cold sleep boxes were now safe in cool chambers nearby. Every day, Omdi Yefri inspected the boxes, looked at each familiar face, checked the diag displays. No sleeper had died since the ambush. What was left on the ship was hard fastened to the hull. Yefri had pointed out the control boards and status elements that managed the container shell's rocket. They stayed strictly away from those. Mr. Steele's quilting shrouded the walls. Yefri's folks' baggage and sleeping bags and exercisers were gone, but there were still the ack-webbing and hard-fastened equipment. And over the months, Omdi Yefri had brought in paper and pens and blankets and other junk. There was always a light breeze from the fan sweeping through the cabin. It was a happy place, strangely carefree even with all the memories it brought. This was where they would save the Tynes and all the sleepers. And this was the only place in the world where Omdi Yefri could talk to another human being. In some ways, the means of talking seemed as medieval as Lord Steele's castle. They had one flat display, no depth, no color, no pictures. All they could coax from it were alpha numerics, but it was connected to the ship's ultra-wave comm, and that was still programmed to track their rescuers. There was no voice recognition attached to the display. Yefri had almost panicked before he realized that the lower part of the screen worked as a keyboard. It was a laborious job typing in every letter of every word, though Omdi had gotten pretty good at it, using two noses to peck at the keys. And nowadays he could read Somnorsh even better than Yefri. Omdi Yefri spent many afternoons here. If there was a message waiting from the previous day, they would bring it up page by page, and Omdi would copy and translate it. Then they would enter the questions and answers that Mr. Steele had talked to them about. Then there was a lot of waiting. Even if Ravna was watching at the other end, it could take several hours to get a reply. But the link was so much better than during the winter, they could almost feel Ravna getting close. The unofficial conversations with her were often the high point of their day. So far, this day had been quite different. After the false workers attacked, Omdi Yefri had the shakes for about half an hour. Mr. Steele had been wounded trying to protect them. Maybe there was nowhere that was safe. They messed with the outside displays, trying to peek through cracks in the rough planking of the compound's walks. "If we'd been able to see out, we could have warned Mr. Steele," said Yefri. "We should ask him to put some holes in the walls. We could be like sentries." They batted the idea around a bit. Then the latest message started coming in from the rescue ship. Yefri jumped into the yak webbing by the display. This was his dad's old spot, and there was plenty of room. Two of Omdi slid in beside him. Another member hopped on the armrest and braced its paws on Yefri's shoulders. Its slender neck extended toward the screen to get a good view. The rest scrambled to arrange paper and pens. It was easy to play back messages, but Omdi Yefri got a certain thrill out of seeing the stuff coming down live. There was the initial header stuff,
That wasn't so interesting after about the 1,000th time you saw it, then Ravna's actual words. Only this time it was just tabular data, something to support the radio design.
Nuts! It's numbers, said Yefri.
Numbers, said Amdi. He climbed a free member onto the boy's lap. It stuck its nose close to the screen, cross-checking what the one by Yefri's shoulder was seeing. The four on the floor were busy scratching away, translating the decimal digits on the screen into the X's and O's and 1's and deltas of Tyne's base 4 notation.
Almost from the beginning, Yefri had realized that Amdi was really good at math. Yefri wasn't envious.
Amdi said that hardly any of the Tynes were that good either. Amdi was a very special pack. Yefri was proud that he had such a neat friend. Mom and Dad would have liked Amdi. Still, Yefri sighed and relaxed in the webbing. This number stuff was happening more and more often. Mom had read him a story once, Lost in the Slow Zone, about how some marooned explorers brought civilization to a lost colony. In that, the heroes just collected the right materials and built what they needed. There had been no talk of precision or ratios or design. He looked away from the screen and petted the two of Amdi that were sitting beside him. One of them wriggled under his hand. Their whole bodies hummed back at him. Their eyes were closed. If Yefri didn't know better, he would have assumed they were asleep. These were the parts of Amdi that specialized in talking.
Anything interesting? Yefri said after a while.
The one on his left opened its eyes and looked at him.
This is that bandwidth idea Ravna was talking about. If we don't make things just right, we'll just get clicks and clacks.
All right. Yefri knew that the initial reinventions of radio were usually not good for much more than Morse code. Ravna seemed to think they could jump that stage.
What do you think Ravna is like?
What? The scritching of pens on paper stopped for an instant. He had all of Amdi's attention, even though they'd talked of this before.
Well, like you, only bigger and older?
Yeah, but... Yefri knew Ravna was from Chandra K. She was a grown-up, somewhere older than Johanna and younger than Mom. What exactly does she look like?
I mean, she's coming all this way just to rescue us and finish what Mom and Dad were trying to do. She must really be a great person.
The scritching stopped again, and the display scrolled heedlessly on. They would have to replay it.
Yes, Amdi said after a moment. She must be a lot like Mr. Steele. It will be nice to meet someone I can hug the way you do Mr. Steele.
Yefri was a little miffed by that.
Well, wait! You can hug me!
The parts of Amdi next to him purred loudly.
I know, but I mean someone that's a grown-up, like a parent.
Yeah. They got the tables translated and checked in about an hour. Then it was time to send up the latest things that Mr. Steele was asking about. There were about 4 pages, all neatly printed in Somnorsh by Amdi. Usually he liked to do the typing, too, all bunched up over the keyboard and display. Today he wasn't interested. He lay all over Yefri, but didn't pay any special attention to checking what was being keyed in. Every so often, Yefri felt a buzzing through his chest, or the screen mounting would make a strange sound, all in sympathy to the unhearable sounds that Amdi was making between his members. Yefri recognized the signs of deep thought. He finished typing in the latest message, adding a few small questions of his own. Things like, how old are you and Fom? Are you married? What are scrotoriders like? Daylight had faded from the cracks in the walls. Soon the digger teams would be turning in their hoes and marching off to the barracks over the edge of the hill. Across the straits, the towers on Hidden Island would be golden in the mist, like something in a fairy tale. Their white jackets would be calling Amdi and Yefri out for supper any minute now. 2 of Amdi jumped off the yak webbing and began chasing each other around the chair.
I've been thinking, Ravna's radio thing. Why is it just for talking? She says all sound is just different frequencies of the same thing.
But sound is all that thought is. If we could change some of the tables and make the receivers and transmitters to cover my tympana, why couldn't I think over the radio? I don't know.
Bandwidth was a familiar constraint on many everyday activities, though Jeffrey had only a vague notion of exactly what it was. He looked at the last of the tables still displayed on the screen. He had a sudden insight, something that many adults in technical cultures never attain.
I use these things all the time, but I don't know exactly how they work. We can follow these directions, but how would we know what to change?
Andy was getting all excited now, the way he did when he'd thought of some great prank.
No, no, no. We don't have to understand everything.
Three more of him jumped to the floor. He waved random sheets of paper up at Jeffrey.
Ravna doesn't know for sure how we make sound. The directions include options for making small changes. I've been thinking. I can see how the changes relate.
He paused and made a high-pitched squealing noise.
Darn, I can't explain it exactly, but I think we can expand the tables, and that will change the machine in obvious ways. And then...
Omdi was beside himself for a moment and speechless.
Oh, Jeffrey, I wish you could be a pack, too. Imagine putting one of yourself each on a different mountaintop and then using radio to think. We could be as big as the world.
Just then, there was the sound of Interpack gobbling from outside the cabin, and then the Somnorsh.
Dinner time. We go now, Omni-Effrey, okay?
It was Mr. Shrek. He spoke a fair amount of Somnorsh, though not so well as Mr. Steele. Omni-Effrey picked up the scattered sheets and carefully slipped them into the pockets on the back of Omni's jackets. They powered down the display equipment and crawled into the main hold.
Do you think Mr. Steele will let us make the changes? Maybe we should also send them back to Ravna.
The White Jackets member retreated from the hatch, and Omdi Jeffrey descended. A minute later, they were out in the slanting sunlight. The two kids scarcely noticed. They were both caught up in Omdi's vision. Chapter 24. For Johanna, lots of things changed in the weeks after scriber Jacques Ramathan died. Most were for the better, things that might never have happened but for the murder, and that made Johanna very sad. She let Woodcarver live in her cabin and take the place of the helper pack. Apparently Woodcarver had wanted to do this from the beginning, but had been afraid of the human's anger. Now they kept the data set in the cabin. There were never less than four packs of Vendacious's security surrounding the place, and there was talk of building barracks around it. She saw the others during the day at meetings and individually when they needed help with the dataset. Scrupolo, Vendacious, and Scarbutt, the Pilgrim, all spoke fluent Somnorsh now, more than good enough so that she could see the character behind their inhuman forms. Scrupolo, prissy and very bright. Vendacious, as pompous as Scriber had ever seemed, but without the playfulness and imagination. Pilgrim Wick Rackscar. She felt a chill every time she saw his big scarred one. It always sat in the back, hunching down to look non-threatening. Pilgrim obviously knew how the sight affected her and tried not to offend, but even after Scriber's death, she couldn't do more than tolerate that pack. And after all, there could be traitors in the Woodcarver Castle. It was only Vendacious's theory that the murder had been a raid from outside. She kept a suspicious eye on Pilgrim. At night, Woodcarver chased the other packs away. She huddled around the fire pit and asked the dataset questions that had no conceivable connection with fighting the Flenserists. Johanna sat with her and tried to explain things that Woodcarver didn't understand. It was strange. Woodcarver was something very like the queen of these people. She had this enormous, primitive, uncomfortable, ugly, yet still enormous, castle. She had dozens of servants, yet she spent most of each night in this little wood lodge with Johanna, and helped with the fire and the food at least as much as did the pack who had been here before. So it was that Woodcarver became Johanna's second friend among the Tynes. Scriber was the first, though she hadn't known it till after he was dead.
Woodcarver was very smart and very strange. In some ways, she was the smartest person Johanna had ever known, though that conclusion came slowly. She hadn't really been surprised when the Tynes mastered Somnorsk quickly. That's the way it was in most adventures, and more to the point, they had the language learning programs in the data set. But night after night, Johanna watched Woodcarver play with the set. The pack showed no interest in the military tactics and chemistry that preoccupied them all during the day. Instead, she read about the slow zone and the beyond in the history of Straumli realm. She had mastered nonlinear reading faster than any of the others. Sometimes Johanna would just sit and stare over her shoulders. The screen was split into windows, the main one scrolling much faster than Johanna could follow. A dozen times a minute, Woodcarver might come upon words she didn't recognize. Most were just unfamiliar Somnorsk. She'd tap a nose on the offending word, and the definition would flicker briefly in a dictionary window. Other things were conceptual, and the new windows would lead the pack off into other fields, sometimes for just a few seconds, sometimes for many minutes, and sometimes the detour would become her new main path. In a way, she was everything that Scriber had wanted to be.
Many times she had questions the dataset couldn't really answer. She and Johanna would talk late into the night. What was a human family like? What had Straumli realm thought to make at the high lab? Johanna no longer thought of most packs as gangs of snake-necked rats. Deep past midnight, the dataset's screen was brighter than the gray light from the fire pit. It painted the backs of Woodcarver in cheerful colors. The pack gathered round her, looking up almost like children listening to a teacher. But Woodcarver was no child. Almost from the first, she had seemed old. Those late-night talks were beginning to teach Johanna about the Tynes, too. The pack said things she never did during the day. They were mostly things that must be obvious to other Tynes, but never talked about. The human girl wondered if Woodcarver, the queen, had anyone to confide in. Only one of Woodcarver's members was physically old. Two were scarcely more than puppies. It was the pattern of the pack that was 500,000 years old. And that showed. Woodcarver's soul was held together by little more than willpower. The price of immortality had been inbreeding. The original stock had been healthy, but after 600 years... One of her youngest members couldn't stop drooling. It was constantly patting a kerchief to its muzzle. Another had milky white in its eyes, where there should have been deep brown. Woodcarver said it was stone blind, but healthy and her best talker. Her oldest member was visibly feeble. It was panting all the time. Unfortunately, Woodcarver said it was the most alert and creative of all. When it died... Once she started looking for it, Johanna could see weakness in all of Woodcarver. Even the two healthiest members, strong and with plush fur, walked a little strangely compared to normal pack members. Was that due to spinal deformities? The two were also gaining weight, which wasn't helping the problem. Johanna didn't learn this all at once. Woodcarver had told her about various Tynish affairs, and gradually her own story came out too. She seemed glad to have someone to confide in, but Johanna saw little self-pity in her. Woodcarver had chosen this path. Apparently, it was perversion to some, and had beaten the odds for longer than any other pack in recorded history. She was more wistful than anything else that her luck had finally run out. Tynes architecture tended to extremes. Grotesquely oversized or too cramped for human use. Woodcarver's council chamber was at the large extreme. It was not a cozy place. You could get 300 humans into the bowl-shaped cavity with room to spare. The separated balconies that ran around its upper circumference could have held another 100 more. Johanna had been here often enough before. This was where most work was done with the data set. Usually there was herself and Woodcarver and whoever else needed information. Today was different, not a day to consult the dataset at all. This was Johanna's first council meeting.
There were 12 packs in the High Council, and they were all here. Every balcony contained a pack, and there were 3 on the floor. Johanna knew enough about Tynes now to see that for all the empty space, the place was hideously crowded. There was the mind noise of 15 packs. Even with all the padded tapestries, she felt an occasional buzzing in her head or through her hands from the railing. Johanna stood with Woodcarver on the largest balcony. When they arrived, Vendacious was already down on the main floor arranging diagrams. As the packs of the council came to their feet, he looked up and said something to Woodcarver. The queen replied in Somnorsh.
I know it will slow things down, but perhaps that's a good thing.
She made a human laughing sound. Peregrine Wick Rackscar was standing on the next balcony over, just like some council pack. Strange. Johanna had not yet figured out why, but Scarbutt seemed to be one of Woodcarver's favorites.
Pilgrim, would you translate for Johanna?
Pilgrim bobbed several heads. Is that okay, Johanna?
The girl hesitated an instant, then nodded back. It made sense. Next to Woodcarver, Pilgrim spoke better Somnorsh than any of them. As Woodcarver sat down, she took the dataset from Johanna and popped it open. Johanna glanced at the figures on the screen. She's made notes. Her surprise didn't have a chance to register before the queen was talking again, this time in the gobble sounds of Interpack talk. After a second, Pilgrim began translating.
Everyone, please sit. Hunker down. This meeting is crowded enough as it is.
Johanna almost smiled. Pilgrim Wick Rackscar was pretty good. He was imitating Woodcarver's human voice perfectly. His translation even captured the wry authority of her speech.
After some shuffling around, only one or two heads were visible sticking up from each balcony.
Most stray thought noise should now be caught in the padding around the balcony or absorbed by the quilted canopy that hung over the room.
Vendacious, you may proceed.
On the main floor, Vendacious stood and looked up in all directions. He started talking.
Thank you, came the translation, now imitating the security chief's tones. The woodcarver asked me to call this meeting because of urgent developments in the north. Our sources there report that Steel is fortifying the region around Johanna's starship.
Gobble, gobble, interruption. Screw below?
That's not news. That's what our cannon and gunpowder are for.
Vendacious.
Yes, we've known of the plans for some time. Nevertheless, the completion date has been advanced, and the final version will have walls a good deal thicker than we had figured.
It also appears that once the enclosure is complete, Steel intends to break apart the starship and distribute its cargo through his various laboratories. For Johanna, the words came like a kick in the stomach. Before, there had been a chance. If they fought hard enough, they might recapture the ship. She might finish her parents' mission, perhaps even get rescued.
Pilgrim said something on his own account, translating. So what's the new deadline?
They're confident of having the main walls complete in just under 10 days. Woodcarver bent a pair of noses to the keyboard, tapped in a note. At the same time, she stuck a head over the railing and looked down at the security chief.
I've noticed before that Steel tends to be a bit over-optimistic. Do you have an objective estimate?
Yes. The walls will be complete between 8 and 11 days from now.
Woodcarver. We had been counting on at least 15. Is this a response to our plans?
On the floor below, Vendacious drew himself together.
That was our first suspicion, Your Majesty.
But, as you know, we have a number of very special sources of information, sources we shouldn't discuss even here.
What a braggart! Sometimes I wonder if he knows anything. I've never seen him stick his asses out in the field.
Huh? It took Johanna a second to realize that this was Pilgrim editorializing. She glanced across the railing. 3 of Pilgrim's heads were visible, 2 looking her way. They bore an expression she recognized as a silly smile. No one else seemed to react to his comment.
Apparently, he could focus his translation on Johanna alone. She glared at him, and after a moment he resumed his business-like translation. "Steele knows we plan to attack, but he does not know about our special weapons. This change in schedule appears to be a matter of random suspicion. Unfortunately, we are the worse for it." Three or four counselors began talking at once. "Much loud unhappiness," came Pilgrim's voice, summing up. "They're full of, 'I knew this plan would never work,' and 'Why did we ever agree to attack the Flincerists in the first place?'"
Right next to Johanna, Woodcarver emitted a shrill whistle. The recriminations dribbled to a halt.
"Some of you forget your courage. We agreed to attack Hidden Island because it has been a deadly threat. One we thought we could destroy with Johanna's cannons, and one that could surely destroy us if Steele ever learns to use the starship."
One of Woodcarver's members, crouching on the floor, reached out to brush Johanna's knee. Pilgrim's focused voice chuckled in her ear.
"And there's also the little matter of getting you home and making contact with the stars, but she can't say that aloud to the pragmatic types. In case you haven't guessed, that's one reason you're here. To remind the chuckleheads there's more in heaven than they have dreamed."
He paused and switched back to translating Woodcarver.
"No mistake was made in undertaking this campaign. Avoiding it would be as deadly as fighting and losing. So, do we have any chance of getting an effective army up the coast in time?"
She jabbed a nose in the direction of a balcony across the room.
"Scrupolo, please be brief."
"The last thing Scrupolo can be is brief. Oops, sorry."
More editorializing from Peregrine. Scrupolo stuck a couple more heads into view.
"I've already discussed this with Vendacious, Your Majesty. Raising an army, traveling up the coast, those all could be done in well under 10 days. It's the cannon, and perhaps training packs to use cannon, that is the problem. That is my special area of responsibility."
Woodcarver said something abrupt.
"Yes, Majesty, we have the gunpowder. It is every bit as powerful as Dataset says. The gun tubes have been a much greater problem. Till very recently, the metal cracked at the breech as it cooled. Now I think I have that fixed. At least I have two unblemished gun tubes. I had hoped for several 10 days of testing."
Woodcarver interrupted.
"But that is something we can't afford now."
She came completely to her feet and looked all around the council room.
"I want full-size testing immediately. If it's successful, we'll start making gun tubes as fast as we can."
"And if not..." 2 days later. The funniest thing was that Scrupolo expected Johanna to inspect the gun tube before he fired it. The pack walked excitedly around the rig, explaining things in awkward somnoish. Johanna followed, frowning seriously. Some meters off, mostly hidden behind a berm, Woodcarver and her high council were watching the exercise. Well, the thing looked real enough. They'd mounted it on a small cart that could roll back into a pile of dirt under the recoil force. The tube itself was a single cast piece of metal about a meter long with a 10-centimeter bore. Gunpowder and shot went in the front end. The powder was ignited through a tiny fire hole at the rear. Johanna ran her hand along the barrel. The leaden surface was bumpy, and there seemed to be pieces of dirt caught in the metal. Even the walls of the bore were not completely smooth. Would that make a difference? Scrupolo was explaining how he had used straw in the molds to keep the metal from cracking as it cooled. The echo.
"You should try it out with small amounts of gunpowder first," she said.
Scrupolo's voice became a bit conspiratorial, more focused.
"Just between you and me, I did that. It went very good. Now for big test."
So you're not a complete flake." She smiled at the nearest of him, a member with no black at all in his head fur. In a kooky way, Scrupolo reminded her of some of the scientists at the high lab. Scrupolo stepped back from the cannon and said loudly,
"It is all okay to go now?"
two of them were looking nervously at the high counselors beyond the berm.
Yes, it looks fine to me.
And of course it should. The design was copied straight from New Yoren models and Johanna's history files.
But be careful. If it doesn't work right, it could kill anybody nearby.
Yes, yes. Having gotten her official endorsement, Scrupolo swept around the piece and shooed Johanna toward the sidelines. As she walked back to Woodcarver, he continued in Tynish, no doubt explaining the test.
Do you think it will work?
Woodcarver asked her quietly. She seemed even more feeble than usual. They had spread a woven mat for her on the mossy heather behind the berm. Most of her lay quietly, heads between paws. The blind one looked asleep. The young drooler cuddled against it, twitching nervously. As usual, Peregrine Wick Rackscar was nearby, but he wasn't translating now. All his attention was on Scrupolo. Johanna thought of the straw that Scrupolo had used in the molds. Woodcarver's people were really trying to help, but... She shook her head.
Who knows?
She came to her knees and looked over the berm. The whole thing looked like a circus act from a history file. There were the performing animals, the cannon. There was even the circus tent. Vendacious had insisted on hiding the operation from possible spies in the hills. The enemy might see something, but the longer Steele lacked details, the better. The Scrupolo pack hustled around the cannon, talking all the time. Two of him hauled up a keg of black powder, and he began pushing the stuff down the barrel. A wad of silk paper followed the powder down the barrel. He tamped it into place, then loaded the cannonball. At the same time, the rest of him pushed the cart around to point out of the tent. They were on the forest side of the castle yard between the old and new walls. Johanna could see a patch of green hillside, drizzly clouds hanging low. About 100 meters away was the old wall. In fact, this was the same stretch of stone where Scriber had been killed. Even if the damn cannon didn't blow up, no one had any idea how far the shot would go. Johanna was betting it wouldn't even get to the wall. Scrupolo was on this side of the gun now, trying to light a long wooden firing wand. With a sinking feeling in her stomach, Johanna knew this couldn't work. They were all fools and amateurs, she as much as they. And this poor guy is going to get killed for nothing. Johanna came to her feet. Gotta stop it. Something grabbed her belt and pulled her down. It was one of Woodcarver's members, one of the fat ones that couldn't walk quite right.
We have to try, the pack said softly.
Scrupolo had the wand alight now. Suddenly he stopped talking. All of him but the white-headed one ran for the protection of the berm. For an instant it seemed like strange cowardice, and then Johanna understood. A human playing with something explosive would also try to shield his body, except for the hand that held the match. Scrupolo was risking a maiming, but not death. The white-headed one looked across the trampled heather to the rest of Scrupolo. It didn't seem upset so much as attentively listening. At this distance, it couldn't be part of Scrupolo's mind, but the creature was probably smarter than any dog, and apparently it was getting some kind of directions from the rest. Whitehead turned and walked toward the cannon. It belly-crawled the last meter, taking what cover there was in the dirt behind the gun cart. It held the wand so the flame at its tip came slowly down on the fire hole. Johanna ducked behind the berm. The explosion was a sharp snapping sound. Woodcarver shuddered against her, and whistles of pain came from all around the tent. Poor Scrupolo. Johanna felt tears starting. I have to look. I'm partly responsible. Slowly she stood and forced herself to look across the field to where a minute ago the cannon had been, and still is. Thick smoke floated from both ends, but the tube was intact. And more, Whitehead was wobbling dazedly around the cart, his white fur now covered with soot. The rest of Scrupolo raced out to Whitehead. The five of him ran round and round the cannon, bounding over each other in triumph. For a long moment, the rest of the audience just stared. The gun was in one piece. The gunner had survived, and, almost as a side effect, Johanna looked over the gun up the hillside. There was a meter-wide notch in the top of the old wall where none had been before. Vendacious would have a hard time hiding that from enemy view. Dumb silence gave way to the noisiest affair Johanna had seen yet. There was the usual gobbling and other sounds, hissing that hovered right at the edge of sensibility. On the other side of the tent, two tines she didn't know ran into each other. For a moment of mindless jubilation, they were an enormous pack of 9 or 10 members. "We'll get the ship back yet." Johanna turned to hug Woodcarver. But the Queen was not shouting with the others. She huddled with her heads close together, shivering.
"Woodcarver?"
She petted the neck of one of the big, fat ones. It jerked away, its body spasming. "Stroke? Heart attack?" The names of olden-day killers popped into her mind. Just how would they apply to a pack? Something was terribly wrong, and nobody else had noticed. Johanna bounced back to her feet.
"Pilgrim!"
she screamed. 5 minutes later, they had Woodcarver out of the tent. The place was still a madhouse, but gone deathly quiet to Johanna's ears. She'd helped the Queen onto her carriage, but after that no one would let her near. Even Pilgrim, so eager to translate everything the day before, brushed her aside. "It will be okay," was all he said as he ran to the front of the carriage and grabbed the reins of the shaggy Watsits. The carriage pulled out, surrounded by several packs of guards. For an instant, the weirdness of the Tynes world came crashing back on Johanna. This was obviously a great emergency. A person might be dying. People were rushing this way and that. And yet, the packs drew into themselves. No one crowded close. No one could touch another. The instant passed, and Johanna was running out of the tent after the carriage. She tried to keep to the heather along the muddy path and almost caught up. Everything was wet and chill, gunmetal gray. Everyone had been so intent on the test. Could this be more Flenser treachery? Johanna stumbled, went down on her knees in the mud. The carriage turned a corner onto cobblestones. Now it was lost to sight. She got up and slogged on through the wet, but a little slower now. There was nothing she could do, nothing she could do. She had made friends with Scriber, and Scriber had been killed. She had made friends with Woodcarver, and now... She walked along the cobbled alley between the castle's storehouses. The carriage was out of sight, but she could hear its clatter on ahead. Vendacious's security packs ran in both directions past her, stopping briefly in side niches to allow opposing traffic by. Nobody answered her questions. Probably none of them even spoke Somnorsh. Johanna almost got lost. She could hear the carriage, but it had turned somewhere. She heard it again behind her. They were taking Woodcarver to Johanna's place. She went back, and a few minutes later was climbing the path to the two-story cabin she had shared with Woodcarver these last weeks. Johanna was too pooped to run anymore. She walked slowly up the hillside, vaguely aware of her wet and muddy state. The carriage was stopped about 5 meters short of the door. Guard packs were strung out along the hill, but their bows weren't knocked. The afternoon sunlight found a break in the western clouds and shone for a moment on the damp heather and glistening timbers, lighting them bright against dark sky above the hills. It was a combination of light and dark that had always seemed especially beautiful to Johanna. Please let her be okay. The guards let her pass. Peregrine Wick Rackscar was standing around the entrance, three of him watching her approach. The fourth, Scarbutt, had its long neck stuck through the doorway, watching whatever was inside.
"She wanted to be back here when it happened," he said.
"What happened?" said Johanna.
Pilgrim made the equivalent of a shrug.
"It was the shock of that cannon going off, but almost anything could have done it."
There was something odd about the way his heads were bobbing around. With a shock, Johanna realized the pack was smiling, full of glee.
"I want to see her."
Scarbutt backed hastily away as she started for the door. Inside, there was only the light from the door and the high window slits. It took a second for Johanna's eyes to adjust. Something smelled wet. Woodcarver was lying in a circle on the quilted mattress she used every evening. She crossed the room and went to her knees beside the pack. The pack edged nervously away from her touch. There was blood and what looked like a pile of guts in the middle of the mattress. Johanna felt vomit rising in her.
Woodcarver?
She said very softly. One of the queen moved back toward Johanna and put its muzzle in the girl's hand.
Hello, Johanna. It's so strange to have someone next to me at a time like this. You're bleeding. What's the matter?
Soft, human-sounding laughter.
I'm hurt, but it's good. See?
The blind one was holding something small and wet in its jaws. One of the others was licking it. Whatever it was wiggling, alive. And Johanna remembered how strangely plump and awkward parts of Woodcarver had become.
A baby?
Yes. And I'm going to have another in a day or two. Johanna sat back on the floor timbers, covering her face with her hands. She was going to start crying again.
Why didn't you tell me?
Woodcarver didn't say anything for a moment. She licked the little one all around, then set it against the tummy of the member that must be its mother. The newborn snuggled close, nuzzling into the belly fur. It didn't make any noise that Johanna could hear. Finally, the queen said,
I don't know if I can make you understand. This has been very hard for me.
Having babies?
Johanna's hands were sticky with the blood on the quilt. Obviously, this had been hard, but that's how all lives must start on a world like this. It was pain that needed the support of friends, pain that led to joy.
No, having the babies isn't it. I've borne more than 100 in my memory's time, but these two are the ending of me. How can you understand? You humans don't even have the choice to keep on living. Your offspring can never be you. But for me, it's the end of a soul 600 years old. You see, I'm going to keep these two to be part of me. And for the first time in all the centuries, I am not both the mother and the father. A newbie I'll become.
Johanna looked at the blind one and the drooler. 600 years of incest. How much longer could Woodcarver have continued before the mind itself decayed? Not both the mother and the father.
But then, who is father?
She blurted out.
Who do you think?
The voice came from just beyond the door. One of Peregrine Wickraxgar's heads peered around the corner just far enough to show an eye.
When Woodcarver makes a decision, she goes for extremes. She's been the most tightly held soul of all time. But now she has blood, genes, data set would say, from packs all over the world, from one of the flakiest pilgrims who ever cast his soul upon the wind.
Also from one of the smartest,
said Woodcarver, her voice wry and wistful at the same time. The new soul will be at least as intelligent as before, and probably a lot more flexible.
And I'm a little bit pregnant myself, said Pilgrim. But I'm not the least bit sad. I've been a foursome for too long. Imagine having pups by Woodcarver herself. Maybe I'll turn all conservative and settle down.
Huh. Even two from me is not enough to slow your pilgrim soul.
Johanna listened to the banter. The ideas were so alien, and yet the overtones of affection and humor were somehow very familiar. Somewhere. Then she had it. When Johanna was just 5 years old, and Mom and Dad brought little Jeffrey home, Johanna couldn't remember the words or even the sense of what they'd said, but the tone was the same as what went between Woodcarver and Pilgrim. Johanna slid back to a sitting position, the tension of the day evaporating. Scrupolo's artillery really worked. There was a chance of getting the ship. And even if they failed, she felt a little bit like she was back home.
Can I pet your puppy?
Chapter 25. The voyage of the Out of Band 2 had begun in Catastrophe, where life and death were a difference of hours or minutes. In the first weeks, there had been terror and loneliness and the resurrection of Fom. The OOB had fallen quickly toward the galactic plane, away from Relay. Day by day, the whirl of stars tilted up to meet them, till it was a single band of light, the Milky Way as seen from the perspective of New Yora and Old Earth, and from most all the habitable planets of the galaxy. 20,000 light-years in 3 weeks, but that had been on a path through the middle beyond. Now in the galactic plane, they were still several thousand light-years from their goal at the bottom of the beyond. The zone interfaces roughly followed surfaces of constant mean density. On a galactic scale, the bottom was a vaguely lens-shaped surface surrounding much of the galactic disk. The OOB was moving in the plane of the disk now, more or less toward the galactic center. Every week took them deeper toward the slowness. Worse, their path, and all variants that made any progress, extended right through a region of massive zone shifting. The Net News had called it the Great Zone Storm, though of course there was not the slightest physical feeling of turbulence within the volume. But some days their progress was less than 80% what they'd expected. Early on, they'd known that it was not only the storm that was slowing them. Blue Shell had gone outside looking over the damage that still remained from their escape.
So, it's the ship itself?
Ravna had glared out from the bridge, watching the now imperceptible crawl of near stars across the heavens. The confirmation was no revelation. But what to do? Blue Shell trundled back and forth across the ceiling. Every time he reached the far wall, he'd query ship's management about the pressure seal on the nose lock. Ravna glared at him.
Hey, that was the nth time you've checked status in the last 3 minutes. If you really think something is wrong, then fix it.
The Scrotorider's wheeled progress came to an abrupt halt. Franz waved uncertainly.
But I was just outside. I want to be sure I shut the port correctly.
Oh, you mean I've already checked it?
Ravna looked up at him and tried to get the sting out of her voice. Blue Shell wasn't the proper target for her frustration.
Yup. At least 5 times.
I'm sorry.
He paused, going into the stillness of complete concentration.
I've committed the memory.
Sometimes the habit was cute and sometimes just irritating. When the riders tried to think on more than one thing at a time, their scrotas were sometimes unable to maintain short-term memory. Blue Shell especially got trapped into cycles of behavior, repeating an action and immediately forgetting the accomplishment. Fom grinned, looking a lot cooler than Ravna felt.
What I don't see is why you riders put up with it.
What?
Well, according to the ship's library, you've had these Scrota gadgets since before there was a net. So how come you haven't improved the design, gotten rid of the silly wheels, upgraded the memory tracking? I bet that even a slow zone combat programmer like me could come up with a better design than the one you're riding.
It's really a matter of tradition, Blue Shell said primly. We're grateful to whatever gave us wheels and memory in the first place.
Ravna almost smiled. By now she knew Fom well enough to guess what he was thinking, namely that plenty of riders might have gone on to better things in the Transcend. Those remaining were likely to have self-imposed limitations.
Yes, tradition. Many who once were riders have changed, even transcended, but we persist.
Greenstalk paused, and when she continued, sounded even more shy than usual.
You've heard of the rider myth?
No, said Ravna, distracted in spite of herself. In the time ahead, she would know as much about these riders as about any human friends, but for now there were still surprises.
Not many have. Not that it's a secret. It's just we don't make much of it. It comes close to being religion, but one we don't proselytize. 4 or 5 billion years ago, someone built the first scrotas and raised the first riders to sentience. That much is verified fact. The myth is that something destroyed our Creator and all its works, a catastrophe so great that from this distance it is not even understood as an act of mind.
There were plenty of theories about what the galaxy had been like in the distant past, in the time of the Ur partition, but the net couldn't be forever. There had to be a beginning. Ravna had never been a big believer in ancient wars and catastrophes.
So, in a sense, Greenstalk said, we riders are the faithful ones, waiting for what created us to return. The traditional scrota and the traditional interface are a standard. Staying with it has made our patience possible.
Quite so, said Blueshell, and the design itself is very subtle, my lady, even if the function is simple.
He rolled to the center of the ceiling.
The scrota of tradition imposes a good discipline, concentration on what's truly important. Just now I was trying to worry about too many things.
Abruptly he returned to the topic at hand.
2 of our drive spines never recovered from the damage at relay. 3 more appear to be degrading. We thought this slow progress was just the storm, but now I've studied the spines up close. The diagnostic warnings were no false alarm.
And it's still getting worse?
Unfortunately so.
So how bad will it get?
Blueshell drew all his tendrils together.
My Lady Ravna, we can't be certain of the extrapolations yet. It may not get much worse than now, or...
You know the OOB was not fully ready for departure. There were the final consistency checks still to do. In a way, I worry about that more than anything. We don't know what bugs may lurk, especially when we reach the bottom and our normal automation must be retired. We must watch the drives very carefully. And hope. It was the nightmare that haunted travelers, especially at the bottom of the beyond. With ultra drive gone, suddenly a light year was not a matter of minutes, but of years. Even if they fired up the ram scoop and went into cold sleep, Jeffrey Olshendot would be 1,000 years dead before they reached him, and the secret of his parent ship buried in some medieval midden. Fom Nguyen waved at the slowly shifting starfields.
Still, this is the beyond. Every hour we go farther than the fleet of Cheng Ho could in a decade. He shrugged. Surely there's some place we can get repairs.
Several.
So much for a quick flight all unobserved. Ravna sighed. The final fitting at Relay was to include spares and tested bottom-compatible software. All that was far away might have been now. She looked at Greenstalk.
Do you have any ideas?
About what?
Greenstalk said. Ravna bit her lip in frustration. Some said the writers were a race of comedians. They were indeed, but it was mostly unintentional. Blueshell rattled at his mate.
Oh, you mean where can we get help? Yes, there are several possibilities. Chandra K is 3,900 lights spinward from here, but outside this storm we...
Too far, Blueshell and Ravna spoke almost in chorus.
Yes, yes, but remember, the Chandra K worlds are mainly human. Your home, my Lady Ravna, and Blueshell and I know them well. After all, they were the source of the crypto shipment we brought to Relay. We have friends there, and you a family. Even Blueshell agrees that we can get the work done without notice there.
Yes, if we could get there.
Blueshell's voter voice sounded petulant.
Okay, what are the other choices?
They are not so well known. I'll make a list.
Her fronds drifted across a console.
Our last chance for choice is rather near our planned course. It's a single-system civilization. The net name is... It translates as harmonious repose.
Rest in peace, eh? Said Fum.
But they had agreed to voyage on quietly, always watching the bad drive spines, postponing the decision to stop for help. The days became weeks, and weeks slowly counted into months.
Four voyagers on a quest toward the bottom. The drive became worse, but slowly, right on OOB's diagnostic projections. The blight continued to spread across the top of the Beyond, and its attacks on network archives extended far beyond its direct reach. Communication with Yefri was improving. Messages trickled in at the rate of one or two a day. Sometimes, when OOB's antenna swarm was tuned just right, he and Ravna would talk almost in real time. Progress was being made on the Tynes world faster than she had expected, perhaps fast enough that the boy could save himself. It should have been a hard time, locked up in a single ship with just three others, with only a thread of conversation with the outside, and that with a lost child. In any case, it was rarely boring. Ravna found that each of them had plenty to do. For herself, it was managing the ship's library, coaxing out of it the plans that would help Mr. Steele and Yefri. OOB's library was nothing compared to the archive at Relay, or even the university libraries at Chandra K. But without proper search automation, it could be just as unknowable. And as their voyage proceeded, that automation needed more and more special care. And things could never be boring with Fahm around. He had a dozen projects and curiosity about everything. "Voyaging time can be a gift," he'd say. "Now we have time to catch ourselves up, time to get ready for whatever we find ahead." He was learning Somnorsh. It went slower than his faked learning on Relay, but the guy had a natural bent for languages, and Ravna gave him plenty of practice. He spent several hours each day in the OOB's workshop, often with Blueshell. Reality graphics were a new thing to him, but after a few weeks he was beyond toy prototypes. The pressure suits he built had power packs and weapons stores. "We don't know what things may be like when we arrive. Powered armor could be real useful." At the end of each workday, they would all meet on the command deck to compare notes, to consider the latest from Yefri and Mr. Steele, to review the drive status. For Ravna, this could be the happiest time of the day, and sometimes the hardest. Fahm had rigged the display automation to show castle walls all around. A huge fireplace replaced the normal window on comm status. The sound of it was almost perfect. He had even coaxed a small amount of fire heat from that wall. This was a castle hall out of Fahm's memory from Canberra, he said. But it wasn't that different from the Age of Princesses on Nuyora, though most of those castles had been in tropical swamps where big fireplaces were rarely used. For some perverse reason, even the riders seemed to enjoy it. Greenstalk said it reminded her of a trading stop from her first years with Blueshell. Like travelers who have walked through a long day, the four of them rested in the coziness of a phantom lodge, and when the new business was settled, Fahm and the riders would trade stories, often late into the night. Ravna sat beside him, the least talkative of the four. She joined in the laughter and sometimes the discussion. There was the time Blueshell had a humor fit at Fahm's faith in public key encryption, and Ravna knew some stories of her own to illustrate the writer's opinion. But this was also the hardest time for her. Yes, the stories were wonderful. Blueshell and Greenstalk had been so many places, and at heart they were traders. Swindles and bargains and good done were all part of their lives. Fahm listened to his friends almost enraptured, and then told his own stories of being a prince on Canberra, of being a slow zone trader and explorer. And for all the limitations of the slowness, his life's adventures surpassed even the Skroda riders. Ravna smiled and tried to pretend enthusiasm, for Fahm's stories were too much. He honestly believed them, but she couldn't imagine one human seeing so much, doing so much. Back on Relay, she had claimed his memories were synthetic, a little joke of old one. She had been very angry when she said it, and more than anything, she wished she never had, because it was so clearly the truth. Greenstalk and Blueshell never noticed, but sometimes in the middle of a story, Fahm would stumble on his memories, and a look of barely concealed panic would come to his eyes. Somewhere inside,
He knew the truth, too, and she suddenly wanted to hug him, comfort him. It was like having a terribly wounded friend with whom you can talk but never mutually admit the scope of the injuries. Instead, she pretended the lapses didn't exist, smiling and laughing at the rest of his story. And Oldwin's jape was also unnecessary. Fahm didn't have to be a great hero. He was a decent person, though egotistical and kind of a rule-breaker. He had every bit as much persistence as she and more courage. What craft Oldwin must have had to make such a person, what power! And how she hated him for making a joke of such a person. Of Fahm's god-shatter there was scarcely a sign. For that, Ravna was very grateful. Once or twice a month, he had a dreamy spell. For a day or two after, he would go nuts with some new project, often something he couldn't clearly explain. But it wasn't getting worse. He wasn't drifting away from her. "And the god-shatter may save us in the end," he would say when she had the courage to ask him about it. "No, I don't know how." He tapped his forehead. "It's still God's own crowded attic up here, and it's more than memory. Sometimes the god-shatter needs all my mind to think with, and there's no room left for self-awareness. And afterwards I can't explain, but sometimes I have a glimmer. Whatever Yefri's parents brought to the Tynes world, it can hurt the blight. Call it an antidote, better yet, a countermeasure. Something taken from the perversion as it was aborning in the Stroumley lab. Something the perversion didn't even suspect was gone until much later." Ravna sighed. It was hard to imagine good news that was also so frightening.
The Straumers could sneak something like that right out from the perversion's heart?
Maybe. Or maybe countermeasure used the Straumers to escape the perversion, to hide inaccessibly deep and wait to strike. And I think the plan might work, Rav, at least if Oldwin's god-shatter can get down there and help it. Look at the news. The blight is turning the top of the beyond upside down, hunting for something. Hitting Relay was the least of it, a small byproduct of its murdering Oldwin. But it's looking in all the wrong places. We'll have our chance at countermeasure.
She thought of Yefri's messages. The rot on the walls of Yefri's ship. You think that's what it is?
Fahm's eyes went vague. Yes. It seems completely passive, but he says it was there from the beginning, that his parents kept him away from it. He seems a little disgusted by it. That's good. Probably keeps his Tynish friends away from it.
1,000 questions flitted up. Surely they must in Fahm's mind, too, and they could know the answer to none of them now. Yet some day they would stand before that unknown, and Oldwin's dead hand would act. Through Fahm. Ravna shivered and didn't say anything more for a time. Month by month, the Gunpowder Project stayed right on the schedule of the library's development program. The Tynes had been able to make the stuff easily. There had been very little backtracking through the development tree. Alloy testing had been the critical event that slowed things, but they were over the hump there, too. The packs of Hidden Island had built the first three prototypes, breech-loading cannon that were small enough to be carried by a single pack. Yefri guessed they could begin mass production in another 10 days. The radio project was the weird one. In one sense, it was behind schedule. In another, it had become something more than Ravna had ever imagined. After a long period of normal progress, Yefri had come back with a counterplan. It consisted of a complete reworking of the tables for the acoustic interface.
"I thought these jokers were first-time medievals," von Neuen said when he saw Yefri's message.
"That's right. Apparently they just reasoned out consequences to what we sent them. They want to support pack thought across the radio."
Yes. We described how the tables specified the transducer grid. All in non-technical Somnorsh.
That included showing how small table changes would make the grid different. But look, our design would give them a 3 kilohertz band, a nice voice grade connection. You're telling me that implementing this new table would give them 200 kilohertz.
Yes, that's what my data set says.
He grinned his cocky smile. Ha, and that's my point. Sure, in principle, we gave them enough information to do the mod. It looks to me like making this expanded spec table is equivalent to solving a, he counted rows and columns, a 500-node numerical PDE. And little Yefri claims that all his data sets are destroyed and that his ship computer is not generally usable.
Ravna leaned back from the display. Sorry. I see what you mean.
You get so used to everyday tools, sometimes you forget what it must be like without them.
You think this might be a countermeasures doing?
Von Neuen hesitated, as if he hadn't even considered the possibility. Then, no, it's not that. I think this Mr. Steele is playing games with our heads. All we have is a bite stream from Yefri. What do we really know about what's going on?
Well, I'll tell you some things I know. We are talking to a young human child who was raised in Straumli realm. You've been reading most of his messages in Trisk translation. That loses a lot of the colloquialisms and the little errors of a child who is a native speaker of Somnorsh. The only way this might be faked is by human adults. And after 20-plus weeks of knowing Yefri, I'll tell you even that is unlikely.
Okay, so suppose Yefri is for real. We have this 8-year-old kid down on the Tynes world. He's telling us what he considers to be the truth. I'm saying it looks like someone is lying to him. Maybe we can trust what he sees with his own eyes. He says these creatures aren't sapient except in groups of 5 or so. Okay, we'll believe that.
Fom rolled his eyes. Apparently his reading had shown how rare group intelligences were this side of the Transcend.
The kid says they didn't see anything but small towns from space, and that everything on the ground is medieval. Okay, we'll buy that. But what are the chances that this race is smart enough to do partial differential equations in their heads and do them from just the implications in your message?
Well, there have been some humans that smart. She could name one case in New Yoran history, another couple from Old Earth. If such abilities were common among the packs, they were smarter than any natural race she had heard of. So this isn't first-time medievalism?
Right. I bet this is some colony fallen on hard times, like your New Yora and my Canberra, except that they have the good luck of being in the beyond. These dog packs have a working computer somewhere. Maybe it's under control of their priest class. Maybe they don't have much else, but they're holding out on us.
But why? We'd be helping them in any case, and Yefri has told us how this group saved him.
Fom started to smile again, the old supercilious smile. Then he sobered. He was really trying to break that habit. You've been on a dozen different worlds, Ravna, and I know you've read about thousands more, at least in survey. You probably know of varieties of medievalism I've never guessed. But remember, I've actually been there. I think.
The last was a nervous mutter. I've read about the Age of Princesses, Ravna said mildly.
Yes, and I'm sorry for belittling that. In any medieval politics, the blade and the thought are closely connected, but they become much more so to someone who's lived through it. Look, even if we believe everything that Yefri says he has seen, this hidden island kingdom is a sinister thing.
You mean the names?
Like Flensers, Steel, Tynes. Harsh names aren't necessarily meaningful.
Fom laughed.
I mean, when I was 8 years old, one of my titles was already Lord Master Disemboweler. He saw the look on Ravna's face and hurriedly added, "And at that age I hadn't even witnessed more than a couple of executions. No, the names are only a small part of it. I'm thinking of the kid's description of the castle, which seems to be close by the ship, and this ambush he thinks he was rescued from. It doesn't add up. You asked, what could they gain from betraying us? I can see that question from their point of view. If they are a fallen colony, they have a clear idea what they've lost. They probably have some remnant technology and are paranoid as hell. If I were them, I'd seriously consider ambushing the rescuers if those rescuers seemed weak or careless. And even if we come on strong, look at the questions Jeffrey asks for Steel. The guy is fishing, trying to figure out what we really value, the refugee ship, Jeffrey and the cold sleepers, or something on the ship. By the time we arrive, Steel will probably have wiped the local opposition, thanks to us. My guess is we're in for some heavy blackmail when we get to Tyne's world."
"I thought we were talking about the good news." Ravna paged back through recent messages. Fom was right. The boy was telling the truth as he knew it, but...
"I don't see how we can play things any differently. If we don't help Steel against the woodcarvers..."
"Yeah. We don't know enough to do much else." End of Side 8. Change side selector switch. This book is continued on the next cassette.